ARUP Institute for Learning presents Insight.
Education.
Leader.
Technology.
Experimental.
Quality.
Esoteric.
Informatics.
Clinical utility.
Patient care.
Research. Laboratory.
Excellence.
Join us as we delve into emerging topics presented by ARUP medical directors who are faculty in the Department of Pathology at the University of Utah School of Medicine.
Tonight, healthcare takes center stage.
The stakes are
millions
high.
Of Americans.
Let's begin with the problems in our current healthcare system.
Yeah, and who's in
but
it?
But this question about healthcare sparks passionate debate.
In the conclusion of this series, Dr. Jackson and Dr. Schmidt finished their discussion by exploring practical advice on how to improve diagnostics within an organization. And Dr. Schmidt turns the tables and gets Dr. Jackson's thoughts on informatics' relationship with managing utilization.
Maybe we could move on to what you're working on right now. Anything you can share with us about what your current area of research is?
I'm doing a couple of different cost-effectiveness analyses. One, I'm working on creatinine assays, which are commonly done in laboratories. And just in our own hospital here alone at the University of Utah, we have the opportunity to save about $100,000 to $200,000 a year by using an older assay, the Jaffe assay, compared to the enzymatic assay. Enzymatic assay is less prone to interferences than the Jaffe assay. And that's sort of a cost-risk trade-off in that, you know, how many diagnostic errors are you willing to make to save $200,000? The problem is the studies that have been done in the past have noted these interferences, but they're in sort of doped samples. So they'll find something that does an interference and go, okay, it gives the wrong answer, but we don't know the prevalence of those in a population. So what we're doing is looking in the cohorts that we have coming to our hospital and going, do these interferences appear one in a million? In that case, it's probably worth saving $200,000. If it's one in 100, it's probably not. If it's somewhere in the middle, you really have to scratch your head. So then you have to go, secondly, okay, for the mistakes we make, what would be the consequences of those? Does that mean that somebody gets shipped off for a kidney transplant immediately? Well, that's a bad consequence. If it's something that people would watch and wait and would be picked up on the second or third test, well, that's another circumstance. But these are very difficult kinds of analyses, and there's no hard and fast rule for these. Another one we're looking at is point-of-care testing for pregnancy testing. There's some advantages to this. There's some disadvantages. The point-of-care testing are based on serum, and they're more accurate than urine, but is it really providing any benefit? So once again, there's trade-offs there in the clinical consequences versus the money saved. They take a long time to do these.
It strikes me that some listeners may be cringing at the very idea of talking about trade-offs between cost and quality.
No, they shouldn't. One way we could save, I forgot the statistic exactly, but it's tens of thousands of deaths a year by eliminating left turns. They account for a great many, many, many of car accidents.
I'll vote against that one.
Think of the time it would cost. But that's just something we routinely accept. And it's the same in medicine. And there's a very good book that was published back in the 80s by Granger Morgan at Carnegie Mellon looking at people's perception of risk. It's things that they're familiar with and have control over, like driving a car. They're happy to drive without a seatbelt. They're happy to accept left turns. But things that they don't have control over, like sitting in the back of an airplane or medical care, they're much more risk averse. So things that people routinely do, that their risk of every time they do it is 1 in 1,000, they accept readily, but they will want stringent controls of things that would have an adverse event in 1 in 1,000,000 when they're not in control of them.
So, Bob, a lot of what we're talking about here is fairly abstract and academic. Part of the role of academics is to point out limitations and flaws and what's hard so that we don't oversimplify. But in a practical sense, let's just say that that one of our listeners is in a position of leadership at a hospital or a health system and wants to do something to improve diagnostics in that setting. Any advice as to where someone might start, someone might think about putting a plan together?
I think they probably know a lot already about how to do this. I mean, I don't think utilization improvement is much different from any other kind of improvement, you know, for patient safety or quality improvement that people probably already have ongoing. So the first thing they need is management support from top leaders that this is a important strategic direction and it's something that will be supported. And after that, I think it's getting key people together, both clinicians and pathologists. And I think they need to think more in terms of base hits than home runs. And big technological interventions like information systems can help, and they definitely have a role. But just identifying a possible project, studying it, looking at a possible intervention, looking at the results, monitoring it, and holding the gains, just the sort of Deming quality improvement cycle can go a long way with this. And this is something I think most organizations are familiar with and can do. Things like, you know, adding cost information to test systems, modifying menus. I mean, you want to support them with some sort of evidence, but these are easy to do. And after some discussions between the clinicians and pathologists, these are, I think, some easy base hits that people can get. Maybe down the road, as electronic health systems become better, we'll be able to apply more broad-based analytics and comparisons across groups and so forth. The other thing, too, about this is that every organization is different. It may be that vitamin D testing is a costly area in one hospital and not in another, so you can't make global prescriptions about targets. And every organization is different politically. It may be that the endocrinologist in one organization is difficult to work with and another one cares a lot about utilization. It's a more attractive target in that organization for that reason. So the landscape is different every place. And so it's like any other kind of improvement project. There's a lot of considerations that go into it. And you can't just give a template of you should do this with, you know, XYZ test.
But it does sound like you think this is very much doable.
Yes.
And something that healthcare organizations should be looking at.
I think they should be. And even with limited evidence, you can make progress.
So does this play into everything that we're hearing about accountable care and medical homes and some of these new organizational structures that are being proposed for healthcare and healthcare reform and things like that?
Well, definitely. We've seen, in talking with our clients, a great increase in interest in the last 2 years in managing tests. In the past, those were passed on. Now they own them. And so there's an incentive to look at what's a useful test or not. And it doesn't need perfect evidence. I mean, we go through our daily lives without perfect evidence. We marry people, buy cars, make all kinds of decisions with imperfect evidence at our disposal. It doesn't mean paralysis. I mean, the better evidence, the better. But there becomes a point of diminishing returns.
Interesting how that works.
Brian, I know your background's in informatics and have worked a lot at decision support here at the University of Utah. I'm just curious about your perspective on how that plays in managing utilization.
Yeah. So my angle on this one is that I think a lot of work in decision support historically has been around automating decision making, in a sense, trying to come up with intelligent systems to replace a portion of a doctor's thinking. And I think that's been a major limitation, because replacing the doctor is one of the hardest conceptual things you could come up with. There are other needs for supporting decisions, i.e. decision support, that are much more tractable and potentially much more useful. The most widely used systems in clinical care today that could be described as decision support are reference materials, in particular different forms, some commercial, some public, of online reference materials. It's not as sexy. It's not automating the doctor's decision-making. It's simply putting evidence at their fingertips to help them with making decisions. Another thing that comes to mind on this topic, a paper I ran across recently on the use of clinical decision support to improve antimicrobial therapy. The conclusion of the paper was that a particular decision support system was able to increase the rate of correct antimicrobial diagnosis by, you know, maybe 10 or 15 percentage points. It sounds useful, but the other interesting thing about the analysis was that they identified that only about half of the diagnoses were actually even correct. So you're trying to diagnose people with infectious diseases so you can apply the right antibiotic therapy. When the diagnosis was correct, then the decision support helped them to select the correct antibiotics more reliably. But what the decision support didn't do anything for was trying to get to the right diagnosis in the first place. So that was really the more fundamental problem, which I thought was very interesting. So my preference would actually be, as a field, to get away from the terminology clinical decision support, not because it's a bad concept and not because the wording is actually bad wording, but because it's come to be associated with a particular flavor of sort of artificial intelligence kinds of applications. If I were, you know, king of the world, I would rebrand it something along the lines of cognitive support. Really, the clinicians that are taking care of patients in this country are a highly educated, talented, intelligent group of individuals who are constrained by the huge breadth of evidence that's out there that's it's impossible to sift through in real time. So systems that present that evidence at the point of care make it easier to know the right background before you make your expert decision strikes me as a more constructive direction. Well, to close up, I'd like to pose two fairly global questions to you. So when you think about diagnostic medicine, first of all, what's your biggest worry, or what keeps you up at night, or what concerns you the most when you think about the future of diagnostic medicine? And then secondly, what excites you the most about the future of diagnostic medicine?
Well, I think the concerns are overdiagnosis is one. I mean, by doing so many diagnoses, these are not benign procedures by any means. Prostate testing is a well-known example of that, that once you get a positive result, you're on a train of investigation that people aren't quite sure whether it does more harm than good. Similarly for thyroid, there's many of these kinds of things. And as testing explodes, there's more and more potential for that. There's a book by Gilbert Welch where he discusses this and gives the analogy of a car with various sort of diagnostic signals. And those can be helpful. You know, you see one blinking that there's low oil pressure or what have you. But imagine that you had 1,000 of these. There would always be something blinking. And we're sort of approaching that with diagnostic testing, where there's so many tests, there's so much potential for false positives that we risk being overdiagnosed. On the other hand, it's a wonderful thing that we have these blinker lights that warn us of problems before they happen. And that's the exciting thing about medicine, is that we're able to diagnose things faster and earlier and less invasively than in the past. But there's a trade-off between these things, between the harms incurred from over-diagnosis and over-intervention versus the benefits that we get from earlier and less invasive diagnosis.
Well, Bob, I really appreciate your time today. I think it's been a fascinating conversation, and I think you've thrown out a lot of stimulating ideas for our listeners to chew on. So,
well, thank you, Brian. It was a pleasure to be here.